the 23rd of February, it will be exactly 2 years since Russia invaded Ukraine. It seems a long time ago now when Russian forces from Belarus tried to conquer the Ukrainian capital of Kiev. The spectacular failure was jumped on by the West, who argued the Red Army could be defeated. 2 years on, however, is a long time and things look very, very different now. Russia appears to be on top, and Ukraine's failed counter-offensive last year is leading to calls for negotiations. The broad support from the West that promised Ukraine as long as it takes has now given way to war fatigue, and since the 7th of October, the war in Gaza has removed Ukraine from the headlines. Here to discuss Ukraine war on its 2-year anniversary is Geopolity founder Adnan Khan. How are you keeping, Adnan? I feel like it's been a while since we've done a podcast.
Yeah, Yusuf, I'm doing well. I was just going to say the same thing. It seems to have been a while, actually.
Yeah, definitely. Now, it's been 2 years since the war started. What's the current battlefield looking like?
Okay, Yusuf. So, pretty straightforward. On the 2-year anniversary, Russia controls and occupies around 20% of Ukraine's territory. And they've occupied 20%, I would say around 20% for at least the last year. So this is the territory that begins from the Donbass region and it goes all the way to the south of Ukraine to where Crimea is. This is where the front lines are. And it seems this is the area that Ukraine's really struggling now to budge the Russian forces. All the NATO weapons Ukraine has received, all the weapons they've received from America, from the Europeans, what you find is not actually given success to Ukraine. And I'm sure we're going to discuss the failed counteroffensive last year. But really, since that counteroffensive, there's actually not been anything from a military perspective from Ukraine. How they plan to change the battlefield reality. How do they plan to make it hell for Russia to occupy this territory? And I would say, Yusuf, on the 2-year anniversary, I can't really see how much more Ukraine can do. I actually think there's actually little more Ukraine can actually physically do. So, you know, 2 years ago, there was a lot of hope. The initial success from Ukraine, everybody felt Ukraine potentially could do this if they had the right help, if they had sufficient help. And 2 years on, I'm not sure what more Ukraine can do. I think they've done what they can. And so that doesn't really bode well for the Ukrainians and anyone that's been supporting Ukraine in this war.
How did Russia end up turning this around?
So that's a good question, Yusuf. Interesting, Yusuf, if you look at historically, this is generally what Russia does. It starts wars badly. You look at the Nazi invasion of Russia. You look at the Chechnya war. Russia starts war badly. And the reason why they start badly is because they believe there's no war going on, or they believe they can win the war very, very quickly. So they generally start wars really, really badly. But what Russia then does and what they've done here is they've adapted. They realize that the initial assumptions were wrong. So then what they do is they adapt and they make decisions which allows them to fight for the long term. So the case in Ukraine, Yusuf, you mentioned in the introduction, the invasion to capture Kiev, and, you know, it failed quite spectacularly. All Russia actually did was they just removed their troops from the north of Ukraine. They realized that operation failed, so they removed them. And so what that did is it means that 30 to 40,000 troops didn't die endlessly. And 30 to 40,000 soldiers, when you move them to another front in Ukraine, it will make a massive difference. Now, what didn't help Yusuf was the belief that because Russia started the war badly, there was belief in the West that Russia's weak, that Russia can be defeated. And that actually has cost them. That's actually cost the West, because we now know, Yusuf, in the first few weeks of Ukraine's invasion, that Russia reached out to the Ukrainian leadership to talk of negotiations. And we know now that Boris Johnson flew to Kiev and managed to convince Zelensky that, look, you're winning. We will help you. We will side by you as long as it takes. You don't need to negotiate. We can win on the battlefield. And 2 years on, that's actually cost them, and it actually helped Russia. Probably, Yusuf, I would say the single thing that helped the most is Russia very quickly converted to a war economy. What Russia's done is all industries, whatever they were doing, even bakers, they are now contributing to the war economy. So whether that's supplying ammunition, whether that's supplying bandages, whether that's supplying a component or something that goes into a tank or a fighter jet, the whole economy is geared towards it. So Although we're talking about what's the battlefield reality, if you can't economically supply the battlefield, your war won't last very long. The other advantage Russia also had is this is not the Iraq or Afghan war where America has to fly supplies from the American continent halfway across the world over to bases to fight. Ukraine shares a border with Russia, so Russia is only going across the border. There are no long supply lines here. So effectively, Russia, the country, has a border with the battlefield. So that actually does make the war effort a lot more easier for Russia. Russia also has, I think, instituted 4 or 5 stimulus packages for the economy to keep the economy afloat. So I think at the moment, Yusuf, most industries in Russia have been roped in to contribute towards the war effort. So all of that, when you put that together, Yusuf, that's how Russia has been able to turn it around.
With the country going into this, what you called a war economy, what's been the response by the people? Have they supported this change in their economy? Are they happy about it? Is there actually discontent?
No, so there hasn't been discontent. You've not seen massive demonstration. There was some opposition against the war. However, the Russians believe Ukraine is really always been a part of Russia. Historically, it's been a part of Russia. So when Russia invaded, the Russian perspective is NATO is using this nation against Russia. So Russia isn't going to war over Ukraine for colonial purposes. When Russia's gone into war in Ukraine, this is in order to defend Russia. So that's why you find the nationalists in Russia, Yusuf, they feel Putin hasn't gone far enough. They feel Putin needs to be more brutal in this actual war effort. Now, if the war was starting to affect the economy, if there was a shortage of bread, shortage of shopping items, and this went on for weeks and months, then I think the response in Russia would actually change. That hasn't happened. And keep in mind, Yusuf, really, since the Afghan war in the 80s, Russia's really been permanently at war in some form or shape. So you had the Afghan war in the 80s under the Soviet Union. Then as soon as the Soviet Union collapsed, they went to war in Chechnya, which went on for all of the 2000s. Then they went to war in Georgia. Then they went into war in Syria. So they've actually been more or less on a permanent war footing. So if there's anything the Kremlin's learned is supply lines, stimulus, the economy. And I'm sure we're going to discuss this. The West had a whole agenda to cripple the Russian economy. That obviously hasn't happened. Now, we're year two, Yusuf. Once you start getting to year four, year five, it will start to impact your economy. And we saw with America now, one of the reasons why people are supporting Trump is they just feel the last 2 decades America's been at war and the war's been the priority rather than domestic America. So it's led to political change potentially in America. At the moment, I think politically, despite how much the West talk about Putin struggling, really there's no talk for political change. And 2 years is a long time, Yusuf, but in the grand scheme of things, World War II went on for 5-6 years. World War I went on for 4 years. If you, relatively speaking, we're still in the early parts of this war.
Adnan, the current negativity towards the war is based mainly around the failed counter-offensive last year. Why did this offensive actually fail?
So the counter-offensive last year was like the main strategy the Ukrainians had. They advertised it. Zelensky traveled to G7, UN conferences, security summits, selling it. His whole thing was, this is the strategy of all strategies and you need to fund it and arm it. Again, it was very optimistic, Yusuf, if I was to look back now, for a country that is not the size of Russia, it doesn't have the resources of Russia, they were being very, very optimistic to make this breakthrough. And what this strategy was, is this front that Russia was holding, which goes from the Donbass region in the east all the way to the south to Crimea. Their plan was that they were going to strike at one point and try and split the area apart. So you have 2 areas with the Ukrainians in the middle. And effectively, that was their strategy. It was very optimistic and obviously it failed. The success Ukraine had prior to this was in the 2022. I think in the summer, they took over Kharkiv in the north of Ukraine and Kherson in the south. And as a result of the success there, they felt that they could carry out bigger operations like the counteroffensive. What they didn't take into account is the counteroffensive last year took place 10 months from the previous counteroffensive.
During those 10 months, Russia didn't just sit still. Russia didn't just occupy land and sit in their barracks. What they did was they expected a counteroffensive from Ukraine. So they built defenses, they built fortifications, and they built structures. And effectively, Ukraine was going to have to get through these if it was going to be successful in this counteroffensive. The general who was in charge of the counteroffensive, he admitted in the end that the fortifications Russia had were very difficult. So this is, you know, when you've got mines, you've got barbed wire, you make like a fortification between you and your enemy on the front lines. And Ukraine struggled to get through it. So by the end of last year, by September, it was accepted that this counteroffensive failed. So really what's happened is it failed because they were very optimistic. And actually, because they have had success prior to this, they felt they could really carry out a major operation. And that's why you find now, Yusuf, Ukraine's prospects, everyone's very negative. The Ukrainians are negative. The West are negative. And that's why it's natural now. There's a lot more talk of maybe Ukraine should just negotiate.
Is this why Zelensky actually sacked his war chief?
Yeah, so what's happened is because Zelensky told the world selling this counteroffensive and it failed, since its failure, the West are reluctant to give more weapons, more heavy weaponry, more funding. So what Zelensky's done is he's effectively wrapped it around his army chief's neck, that you were the leader and because of you it failed. He blamed it on him. Now, we're going to take a few other things into account here. That firstly, the army chief was very popular. According to polls, he was even more popular than Zelensky. So Zelensky saw him as a bit of a competitor. In theory, there's supposed to be elections in May in Ukraine. And obviously, because Ukraine is not winning, it's not going to be good for Zelensky. So what Zelensky seems to have done is he's effectively showing the world the counteroffensive failed. It was his fault. So I've dealt with him. I've removed him. So he sort of like washed his hands off him. And that we've got to take that into account, really, because Zelensky was the one traveling the world selling this counteroffensive, wasn't the army chief. And the army chief executed the plan that they come up with. So a lot of this is, it's not just battlefield reality, it's politics as well.
Adam, I think previously we've made some assumptions about what the war would look like going forward. I think it's a good time to revisit these assumptions that we made. One of these assumptions we made is you said that you didn't think Russia would invade, and then it did. Have you been able to reconcile this with what we see now in hindsight?
So, thanks for reminding me again that I got it wrong.
My pleasure.
So, no, Yusuf, at the moment, there's still a lot of information we just don't have. I mean, we still don't know what was the actual reason Russia invaded. The American propagandist, Tucker Carlson, he recently did an interview with Putin. And in that interview, Putin spoke at length about history and Ukraine's a part of Russian heritage. He didn't really explain any tactical or strategic decision-making that they did to actually do this. So, no, on that one, Yusuf, 2 years on, we still don't know exactly. What seems to be the general message, Yusuf, is NATO and the West was expanding and Russia felt it had to do something. That's generally where I'm sitting at the moment. Obviously, there's a lot of detail we don't know yet, and obviously in time we know, but that's where I really am with that. I mean, the reason why I thought Russia wouldn't invade is I just thought Russia had more tools in its toolbox that it could use. It could use the pro-Russian element of Ukraine. It could do a coup. It could use oil. It could use economics. And it had done that in Belarus. It had done that in Kyrgyzstan. It had done that in Armenia. So I just felt war was a very risky strategy. Why would Putin do it? But obviously Putin's done that now. And, you know, geopolitics, we go with what is rather than what could have been. And yeah, that's where I really am with that one.
Adnan, why did Russia start the war so poorly?
So we know now, Yusuf, 2 years on, it was actually more straightforward than even I believed. What Russia did, and this has happened in many examples in history, is they thought if we did a blitzkrieg, a lightning attack on the capital falls, the war's over. The troops won't fight. People would accept that they've been defeated. And I don't think that's a bad strategy. And in the end, they didn't pull it off. Actually executing it, they were very poor. But once Russia realized that strategy had failed, they removed their troops from the north of Ukraine. So they had a strategy. It didn't work. They realized it. Rather than continuing to try and achieve the same strategy, they removed their troops to fight another day. So, you know, as much as, you know, the Russians have always had this Soviet thing around them that they're very inflexible. People will continue doing something rather than thinking on the battlefield. That's the Russia of the past. What you're finding in this war, Russia has done things which from a propaganda perspective doesn't look good, but it allowed them to fight another day. So really, Yusuf, their blitzkrieg tactic just didn't work. And once they realized that, they're adaptive.
Putin was recently interviewed by Tucker Carlson. He seems to have had a mixed response. How much can we draw from that interview?
So Yusuf, it's quite a long interview. And at least half of it, Putin is giving the very long history of Russia, going back to the 9th, 10th century onwards. I mean, Tucker Carlson, Yusuf, you've got to remember, he's not actually a journalist. He's a propagandist. He's been sacked as a journalist for every organization he worked for. And he is part of the faction in America who are more impressed with Putin and Xi Jinping than their own president. So they look at America, they see LGBTQ, they see homosexuality, they see wars, and they see this as bad for America. And they look at Putin, who clamps down on homosexuals, he doesn't allow LGBTQ. So they seem to have more in common, they feel, with Putin the way, rather than Biden or Obama and these sort of guys. So that's the first thing you've got to keep in mind about Tucker Carlson. And really, he did give Putin a very easy ride. You didn't question him. He didn't come back a lot. You didn't do a pace morgue on him. We forced him. In fact, Putin, if anything, this was Putin effectively giving a talk to the world. The important thing to realize in this interview, Yusuf, this was Putin talking to a Western audience. And what he did was, let me explain to you why we invaded Ukraine and how we view it. He's basically saying, forget what Biden and Boris Johnson and the EU are telling you. Let me tell you from our side. And his story in a nutshell is, Ukraine historically has been a part of Russia, and the West are invading a former territory of Russia. And when I mean a territory, I mean culturally, historically. And funny enough, Yusuf, a lot of people accept his argument. A lot of people were very critical of Biden and America, what they've been doing regarding this war. So I think that's all you can really look at with this interview. I don't think it's going to change the battlefield reality. I think the people that liked Putin, they liked the interview, but it's not going to really change anything on the battlefield. I mean, we've got to view this really as part of the propaganda war, and the propaganda is important when it comes to war. And this interview took place around the 2-year anniversary of the Ukraine war. So effectively, Russia, the Russian leader is talking to the Western crowd and telling them all the things they told you at the beginning of the war. Here we are 2 years later, I'm on top, Russia's on top, we have a historical right to this land, basically your rulers lied to you. So from a propaganda perspective, that is really what this interview was more about.
I think we all know the answer to this question, but we need to ask it. Would it be correct to say Ukraine is losing the war?
So if we look at the facts, Yusuf, Russia is a bigger country than Ukraine. It has a larger economy. Russia is the 11th largest economy in the world. It's one of the world's largest producers of oil, of gas, of wheat, of gold. Russia could throw a lot more at this war. That's not the situation Ukraine's in. Ukraine is completely dependent upon the West. It's completely dependent upon their sentiment, upon their politics. So it's not really a like-for-like a comparison. Now, can Ukraine change the battlefield reality? It could if a number of things happen. So firstly, it needs more troops. I think just recently they reduced the age of conscription. But if Western troops were to be embedded with them, that would make a big difference. But nobody will do that politically. The Germans, the Brits, the Americans, you know, if you want to lose an election, that's a good way to lose elections. The other thing that would help Ukraine is heavier, more sophisticated weapons, which the West are reluctant to give. Well, you find every weapon, whether it's a tank, whether it's a fighter jet, whether it's HIMARS, it turns into a debate that goes on for a few months, and then they end up giving them a quarter of what they requested. The more heavier, sophisticated weapons would really help Ukraine. So weapons like drones, for example, this could really turn the tide. I mean, they're using drones at the moment in Ukraine from Turkey, but these are not very sophisticated. But all of these, Yusuf, more troops, heavier weapons, drones, it's all based on Western sentiment. And Western sentiment at the moment is not for prolonging the war. It's not for, let's keep the war going and we potentially could win. And with the failed counteroffensive last year, there seems to be very little appetite, really, to expand this war.
Yeah, I feel like the West has become more disinterested in the conflict in Ukraine. And it does seem like Zelensky has become more desperate. Now, if we look at the other side, Russia. Russia has now become the most sanctioned country in history. A broad range of sanctions were placed on Russia when it invaded, and we're told the Russian economy would collapse. But it clearly hasn't. So what's gone wrong here?
So, yeah, there was another claim early in the war that hasn't quite turned out the way the West believed. So, Yusuf, you know, with sanctions, they're workable to the point everyone implements them. If a couple of countries implement sanctions, so you don't sell something to Russia, you don't buy something, that's fine if Russia can't find other customers or Russia can't find other sellers. If you refuse to sell oil to Russia, Russia can go somewhere else. So sanctions really are only workable to the point that everyone implements them. And that's been the first problem. Not everyone's implementing them. Then I think we need to put this into perspective, Yusuf. If you're going to go to an economic war with Russia, this is not Iraq or Afghanistan. This is not Venezuela. You're talking about a $2 trillion economy, the 11th largest in the world. This is a country where the economy has been growing 3% a year during the war, more than the Western economies. That's what you're really dealing with here. So we saw several thousand sanctions, really, as you mentioned, the most in history on Russian individuals, businesses and government institutions. And yeah, this did cause a mild recession, but Russia was very quickly able to turn this around. Now, there's one fundamental reason, Yusuf, why Russia was able to turn this around and why the West failed. It's because Russia has a lot of gold, grain, oil, gas, and friends and allies to sell it to. Let me repeat that, Yusuf. It has some key commodities the world needs. Gold, grain, oil, and gas. These are not commodities that everybody has or everybody has in bulk. So the Europeans, they reduced the energy imports from Russia as part of the sanctions. So they've gone from 45% of the energy coming from Russia now down to about 4%. But all Russia did, Yusuf, is replace Europe with China, with India and Turkey. Now remember, China and India, you're looking what's that? Two, potentially 3 billion people. There's only 400 million people in Europe. So that's what I meant about Russia has gold, grain, oil and gas, and friends to sell it to as well. So currently 90% of all Russian crude oil goes to India and China. More of Russia's gas now goes to China. So previously, at least half of Russian gas and oil used to go to Europe. But what Russia's also done, Yusuf, is it's created an enormous shadow fleet. So what the West did is they put sanctions, not just on oil and gas, but even the tankers and the insurance companies that support it. So what Russia did is it created a complete new fleet of shadow fleet of tankers. So these are tankers that don't belong to any country. They pick up oil and they bring it to Russia or to Russia's allies. So during the war, Yusuf, Russia has still been exporting 7.5 million barrels of oil a day. That is nearly the same amount as Saudi Arabia. This is a country under sanctions and is still producing and exporting oil. Similarly, despite Western sanctions, Russia's share of global wheat exports actually increased over the past 2 years. So what we're finding, Yusuf, despite what the West said, sanctions are cheap and easy to impose, but very seldom do they actually work? Because unless everyone implements them, they're not going to work. So despite India's relationship with America, despite Turkey's relationship with America, getting access to cheap commodities from Russia was too good an opportunity to give up. And that's why 2 years on, the Russian economic situation is way better than Ukraine's.
So with this picture in mind, and there's a lot of talks about negotiations, do you think negotiations could happen? What do you think Russia would want to press forward? Is Zelensky more inclined to negotiate now?
So it seems, Yusuf, Zelensky has never been the main opposition to sanctions. The sanctions, the opposition really come from the West. We know now in the first 2 weeks, Russia reached out to Ukraine, Zelensky, and it was the West who told him no. Even some of the negotiation terms that Zelensky has proposed, they've been turned down by the West. It's true when people say it seems the West wants to prolong the war because they've got other objectives with Russia. Those objectives are not objectives that Ukraine has. You know, Ukraine is in a war, someone's taking the land, they want to get it back, or let's negotiate. It seems the West want to actually achieve other aims. So the first peace plan, Yusuf, we saw very early on,
December 2022. The war began February 2022. This was the Zelensky 10-point peace plan. He called for a global summit on this and he presented it to the G7 summit. There's been a couple of conferences over this in Denmark and we saw one last year summer in Saudi. What this is, Yusuf, this 10-point peace plan, it's an attempt to get most of the world's countries on the same page that this is the peace plan. And so they back it and then it can sit down with Russia and negotiate it. The problem is this 10-point peace plan talks a lot about sovereignty and borders, which you've lost, which Ukraine doesn't have. So there is a question mark, really, of how practical this will be. Then we saw Yusuf in February 2022. Xi Jinping, he called for a freezing of what's going on and to have some discussions. Zelensky was very keen for this, but the West rejected it. The most recent meeting, Yusuf, was actually the Davos summit in January last month. So more nations were present and more nations got on board. And obviously the most important nation, Russia, wasn't there. It was, in fact, none of these talks Russia's been invited to. That doesn't help. But there's another question we have to ask, Yusuf. If 2 years on, Russia's on top, if Russia's in a winning position, if Russia's got 20% of Ukraine and there's nothing Ukraine can do, why does Russia need to negotiate? Russia's in a position of strength. So unless Ukraine can compromise, really, Russia's in a strong position. I mean, Russia can negotiate if he wants, but if Russia's going to negotiate, Russia will negotiate once the sanctions are removed. And keep in mind, Yusuf, Putin at the beginning of last year, he mobilized 600,000 new troops. These troops have not been thrown at the war yet. So these troops are thrown at the war, Zelensky has a massive problem. And with the West's attention on Palestine, it will be very, very difficult for Zelensky. So there isn't any serious discussions about negotiations. At the moment, it still seems to be just get the war together on the terms. But the country that matters the most, Russia, they're in a position, do you really need to negotiate? Do you really need to be at the negotiating table? You're in a position of strength.
What impact do you think Alexei Navalny's death will have on Russia's war effort?
So, you know, unfortunately, he's been getting a lot of attention, this dissident from Russia who passed away over the weekend. He's been in prison for a while. The West have given him a lot of attention. And, you know, unfortunately, his death will have zero impact on the war effort. I feel, Yusuf, he's actually been oversold. He was a dissident. He was against the corruption he saw with the Putin regime. So he led a whole campaign. That's what he was about. The problem is he's one person. One person generally doesn't have an effect on a war. What you find is an institution, the whole army, an E-class or a faction. And also, to be honest with you, he's been in prison since 2022. So since Russia invaded, he's been in prison. He's not really had any say. His group is more or less fractured. So his death, to be honest with you, is something the West are trying to use as propaganda against Putin. In terms of the war effort, it has absolutely zero impact. It's a bit like, you know, the death of the Wagner leader, Prigozhin. The West gave it a lot of coverage. This is the fracturing of the Putin regime. He died in August, 6 months on Yusuf. It's had zero impact on the war effort.
Questions down on what we know now that we didn't initially. So who blew up Nord Stream?
So it's funny, Yusuf, because America was very open that they were unhappy about Nord Stream, Nord Stream 2. They said it should be blown up, and then it got blown up. So really, America was behind it. 2 years on, this is clear. Seymour Hersh even did a whole investigation, and he gave the details of how some of the European countries were really involved by America organizing it. In many ways, Yusuf, looking back now, this wasn't a big thing in the war because Russia and Europe were already going in the direction where they were going to stop buying and selling energy to each other. So by blowing up the pipeline, they were already going in the direction. And this pipeline went to Germany. It didn't go to the rest of Europe. So in many ways, Yusuf, this pipeline is blowing up. Although it's a tactic, on the overall war effect, it had very little impact.
Is there still a threat of nuclear war?
So what should be clear now, Yusuf, is the use of nuclear war really, or all the statements that have come about, especially in the early days, it's really all propaganda purposes. There's never been a threat of nuclear war. What you find is when Putin was struggling at the beginning of the war, when they were losing and when the blitzkrieg was failing, he would throw around statements regarding nukes so the West would get worried and the West would start talking about their nukes and nuclear war and things like that. All of this was really just to prove the seriousness of the war. And how everyone, even if you oppose the war, you've got to get behind your governments because
there potentially could be a nuclear war. 2 years on, Yusuf, I mean, we could see that there was never a possibility of nuclear war. You drop a nuke in Ukraine, the radioactive fallout will go to Russia. And also, Russia started the war badly. Now it's got 20% of the country. All this has been achieved without nuclear weapons. So what you find, Yusuf, the nuclear weapons discussion was all for propaganda purposes.
Do you think there'll be a World War III?
So, Yusuf, I've always said I don't think there will. But I think there's a few things we've got to think about. Obviously, this public question comes on the back of recently, there's been a lot of talk in Europe that people need to get ready for conscription. People need to get... Effectively, what's being said, Yusuf, is 2 years into the war, Russia's on top. And if the Europeans are going to turn this around, you might end up seeing a European continent-wide war. So that's a world war. And if you remember, conscription was compulsory. People across Europe had to go to war. And so this is being pushed out in a lot of European countries to see what the reaction of the people is. And you're seeing no one love for it. Nobody wants to go to war. Nobody wants to be in a European continental war. People are against the war, and people feel the Europeans have been cutting their defense so much, they're now in a position where they won't be actually able to fight. Now, each of the times we had a world war, Yusuf, nobody thought they would. What you find is you had European countries who had their strategic imperatives, and these were under threat, and then this led to other European powers and other powers to join, and then it became a world war because all the main powers were involved. So from that perspective, this has the possibility. If Ukraine is losing this war, Russia has expanded. Russia now is on the border with Poland, which is a NATO country. So these are the scenarios where you can get a European-wide war and it brings in all the powers. So it is possible. I still think it's a distant prospect. It's been 70 years plus since the last World War. The European continent, I saw an infographic recently, Yusuf, where you had a world map and there was a dot to represent every war in history. And what you find is nearly all the dots are all in Europe. This is a continent that has been at war throughout history, and it will probably continue to be at war. So although I think World War III is far off, that's what was said before World War I, World War II. So the factors that can lead to a world war, they are there, right? So that's probably what we need to keep in mind.
Why are Russia's allies not helping? I know you said that Russia has a lot of friends buying their oil and their gold and their grain. But why aren't they actually helping within the war effort?
So I think when we look at the West, Yusuf, you've got America, you've got Britain, you've got France, you've got Germany, you've got the other European countries who are physically providing arms and equipment and planes and training. So they are all physically involved in the war. We don't see that on the Russia side. What we see on the Russia side is Russia itself is doing the fighting. There are Russian troops, they're Russian forces, and generally they're Russian-made weapons. What you're finding, though, Yusuf, is a few times Russia has reached out to North Korea for ammunition. There's a couple of times they've reached out to China for resupplies for some weapons, but these are like individual cases. They're not on a continued basis like we're seeing with the West. The main reason why the Allies are not helping, if we compare it to the West, is because Russia's fighting the war. It's on the border with Russia. As far as Russia's concerned, it's an internal war. Russia doesn't need troops and it doesn't need other countries to fight with them. What they need is for them to buy their goods, is for them to transfer currency with them, is for them to help their economy. And maybe in certain areas, they may need to buy resupplies. Russia's satisfied with that. The problem is, you know, from a propaganda perspective, the West has made this out to be a war between the West and the East. But all the West are with Ukraine. Now, if Russia wanted to do that, it could. I think there'll be problems. I don't think India, Turkey, and China would openly want to side with Russia, that they are completely on the Russian side. But from an economic and a military perspective, they have supplied. I mean, Turkey might be buying Russian energy, but it's also been selling drones to Ukraine that's been used in them against Russia. China, obviously, is not part of the war effort, but is buying and selling lots of Russian energy and helping their economy. And India is more than happy to continue buying Russian energy at cheaper prices. So they are helping, but in more indirect ways. And that's because Russia's satisfied in fighting the war and prostituting it himself.
What is the Wagner doing now?
So this is a good question, Yusuf, because the West made a lot out of this back in, I think, August, September, where the Wagner tried to do their coup. And then eventually the Wagner leader died in mysterious circumstances in a plane accident. They're not doing much, Yusuf. The Wagner thing kicked off, Yusuf, because the defense minister, he wanted to integrate Wagner forces into the Russian army. which Prigozhin didn't want, and that's what eventually led to his coup attempt. What's happened since then is most of Wagner has been subsumed by the Russian army. It's come under the Minister of Defense now. But the Wagner forces that are in Africa and other countries, they've continued as normal. The difference now is they take orders directly from Kremlin rather than Prigozhin, who dealt with the Kremlin. So in the end, Yusuf, what happened with Wagner had zero impact on the war effort, despite the West getting really excited.
Are the West losing interest in the Ukraine war?
Yes, this is quite interesting, Yusuf. It was the end of last year where there's a lot more chatter from the West that Zelensky needs to negotiate. And what that meant, Yusuf, is the West have come to the point where they don't really want to continue, where they don't want to continue this trajectory, where they don't want to keep supplying more weapons. And I don't think what also did it help was the 7th of October and what's going on in Palestine. Even Zelensky's been told some of the equipment that was sent to him has to be transferred to Israel. The Western public, yeah, they've lost interest a long time ago, Yusuf, where they welcome Ukrainian citizens into their country. Now they're saying, well, they're a drain on the economy. And, you know, 2 years for a population is very, very long. And it was given wall-to-wall coverage. And really, whatever it takes now is being turned into, we can't really be watching this for any longer. So the West is losing interest, and there seems to be more of a push now that they need to start negotiating. But again, the problem is Zelensky will not be negotiating from a position of strength.
And finally, why does the US Congress not approve more funding to Ukraine?
So purely political, Yusuf, Congress is dominated, or the majority is in the hands of the Republicans. The White House is in the hands of the Democrats. And what the Republican Congress is doing is they are using Ukraine funding proposals to get deals on other funding that they want. So building a wall with Mexico, reducing taxation, and they don't care. They don't care about Ukraine. They don't care that this money is necessary for Ukraine. I think America, Yusuf, had to lend it. The aid goes into hundreds of billions now that they've been shifting to Ukraine. So it's not they've lost hope. It's not they strategically can't do the other priorities. It's purely political. The Republicans are more than happy to support bills for funding for Ukraine, so long as Biden agrees on also funding other pro-Republican policies. So if you're Zelensky and you could have stopped this war in the first 2-3 weeks, remember the first 2-3 weeks, Russia, apart from Donbass, it didn't really control anything else. You're probably thinking, probably looking back, that would have been a good time to actually negotiate. And when you see Congress using you as a political football, you must be thinking, what on earth have I got myself into?
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. If you want to learn more about the issues we've raised today, please check out our website. That's www.thegeopolity.com, all one word. You can also learn more on many other issues by accessing our website. You'll find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.